Welcome to The Creative Shift. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. Okay, today I'm ridiculously excited to share my interview with singer-songwriter Mike Madison. He is the author of the new book, Poetic Songverse, Blues-Based Popular Music and Poetry, which was co-authored with Ernest Suarez. So there is so much to mine in this interview. If you are anyone doing creative work and considering what does it mean to develop a career as a creator, but even more than that, finding purpose and fulfillment with what you create. Oh my gosh, this podcast is just oozing with wisdom that Mike shares. So Mike is sort of probably best known as a member of the Derek Trucks band. Derek Trucks, if you don't know, he was sort of a guitar prodigy. He, you know, from the time he was 11, 12, 13 years old, was getting major notoriety as a guitarist. He played for years with the Allman Brothers Band. Rolling Stone has named him one of the 100 greatest guitarists of all times on multiple occasions. And, you know, he's had this band that Mike has been a part of. Derek later combined forces with his wife to create a new band called the Tedeschi Trucks Band, which Mike is also a member of. And in this interview, we really cover the entire scope of Mike Madison's career. We talk about, you know, what it was like to grow up and to find purpose in creativity, how he developed his musicianship, and how he took that idea of from creating songs and singing and playing all these different instruments to forging a career. We talk about that difference between doing something as sort of a hobby and maybe a personal craft to being a professional, and what that means in terms of sometimes the quote-unquote compromise, and also the relationship between what an audience expects of you and what you're creating for yourself. We talk about the many transitions, the many creative shifts in his life, from when he was playing with his own band in New York and really living for these, you know, six or seven performances a month, to how Derek Trucks came to know of him, which is something I hope I talk about a lot in different ways, which is through his network. Derek found Mike because two different people shared Mike's CD with him. And that gave Mike an incredible opportunity where he went from playing maybe to 100 people a night for a show to playing to thousands. We talk about what it was like to be a part of creating a Grammy award-winning album with the Derek Trucks Band, and then the transition, which was a major transition from not just being a part of Derek Trucks Band to the transition of him and his wife combining these two bands, which changed Mike's role in that. We, of course, talk about his new book, which is an amazing and unique look at the history of popular music and popular music, especially from the 60s and 70s, as it relates to poetry. It's just so fascinating. This is one of those podcasts where there was so much in here. I only worry that I can't do it justice in how much I talk about it. All right, this is Mike Madison. Hey, everyone, this is Dan Blank. I'm very excited to be chatting with Mike Madison. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So we have a lot to cover. And the place I always like to begin when I'm speaking with anyone who does creative work is this idea of when you were growing up, did you feel you had a sense of permission to create?
You know, I did. And I think I'm lucky that I did. My parents were both Lutheran ministers, and they were kind of in touch with the ethereal, if you will, and they just thought that I was just a fascinating, funny little creature, and they kind of let me do my thing.
So were you encouraged in terms of music or art or speaking or anything like that? Or was it just you found this on your own and they didn't stand in your way?
You know, my mom actually was kind of an amateur want to be musician. And she noticed when I was pretty young that I would sing along with advertisements on TV, but I would sing the harmony that wasn't there. And she's like, that's interesting. And so she signed me up for a really cool thing. This is in Minneapolis, Minnesota in the in the 70s, which is a pretty progressive, interesting place. And there's a thing called Musical Trolley. And you'd go downtown to this McPhail School of Music, and every week they'd have a different instrument that you could explore. So they'd let you handle a viola or a, you know, trombone or something like that. And that kind of got me fascinated with music. And I remember one day it was the string bass. And apparently, I don't remember this, but apparently I was just fascinated by it. And I came home and I told my mom, it's like, that's what I'm going to do with my life. And so I did. I played bass for many years, starting in elementary school, and that kind of got me on my way.
What was it that helped you pick that? Because I think of that age where I was the art kid, so I was drawing, but it's that idea of something that really stands out. I feel like a lot of kids, I'm into soccer, I'm into art or whatever it is, and not only to pick it up, but to stick with it for more than maybe 2 or 3 years. Was it the music? Was it the feeling? Was it your creativity? What was it that kept you digging deeper into the craft?
I don't know. I mean, with the string bass, it was a huge thing. It was, you know, as a kid, you could sit on it. It was like a piece of furniture. And then the sound it made was just so resonant and serious and maybe adult sounding or something, that it just kind of stuck with me. At the same time, she had me doing piano lessons, which I really did not like and fought against, but the bass was something that I just wanted. And I don't know if you've ever played one, but you when you play it, you hug it. It's a very emotional connection.
Were you playing in school bands? Were you playing with other kids locally? Anything like that?
I did. I played in the school band, and then eventually with the string bass, you couldn't play in the, you know, marching band or anything. So I was in the chamber group. And so you're playing classical music and kind of getting the grip on the classical repertoire, which was, it wasn't the cool thing to do, but it ended up being quite helpful in future endeavors.
And how was that balanced with what you were consuming musically? Because if we're talking about the 70s or early 80s at all, there's so much else going on either historically of the last 20 years or of that moment. And I can imagine a child studying this, but also being drawn to some other kind of music as well.
Well, that was the cool thing about the bass is if you turn it sideways, it's a bass guitar. And so I also got a bass guitar, so I could kind of have a toe in either world. And so it was fun to just kind of learn the craft with the chamber group. But then at the same time, you could just take that and bring it into pop music and what was going on, especially in Minneapolis in the 70s, 80s. It was a fascinating time because you had the R&B thing going on with Prince and his kind of family of bands. But then you had this, what would become, I guess, alternative music, college radio with the Replacements and Husker Du and Soul Asylum. And so you, the cool thing with the bass is you could be like a punk rock Mozart, you know. My colleagues at the time who played violin and stuff couldn't cross that line, and I could. So it was a very gratifying, interesting time to be in music in Minneapolis.
Were you getting into the scene early on? Because again, I'm always trying to think of that difference between I'm in music classes, I'm in my school, like that local thing versus actually performing somewhere or even just becoming an observer, being in the back of the room at some kind of concert hall.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the cool thing about music then too is that this alternative stuff, which became alternative rock, I guess, wasn't on the radio. And so it was all word of mouth, and they would have all ages shows, you know, so after school, you'd go down to the 7th Street entry or something, and you'd see these bands, you know. I saw the Replacements, I saw Husker Du and all that stuff. And it was just, it was a very participatory. It was something you did as a group. You had to find it. It didn't come to you. You had to want it. So that was cool. And then also it was the time when you you formed your own bands. So there was no school of rock or anything. You just had to know somebody who knew somebody, and you'd go set up in a garage and you'd be like, hey, this is happening. Or, you know, these guys are for shit. Or you had to negotiate it yourself as a 13, 14 year old. And so that was I think that's a really great experience. I'm not sure if that happens a lot anymore, but I would highly recommend it.
Well, it's interesting. Think of the impetus of what brings people together. I hope it happens, but I think it's easier to also find that just on your phone by yourself in a room on some kind of social media.
Yeah, I would agree.
So is this falling into high school, and were you kind of thinking about, as you were going through that age, were you thinking about what you might want to do, whether music is your future or was it something else?
That's a great question. You know, being from the Midwest, there's definitely a practicality that is instilled early on. And I was told from the get-go that, you know, music is very difficult. It's probably not a career path. And so it's something I always did, but I always, you know, had my eyes on something else. But I always hoped that music would become the thing I did, but I didn't go all in on it. It was kind of always a back burner thing. And so I lucked out in my early adulthood when it finally became something that I could do professionally.
At what point does writing kind of enter your focus, whether it's a main thing or a side thing?
That's something I always wanted to do. That was what I wanted to be, was a writer. And I always loved my English classes and loved reading books and literature. And that's what I studied in college too. And again, it's something I always did, hoping it would take. And it just happened. I lucked out that music happened first. But when I, in the mid 90s or late 90s, when I met up with Derek Trucks and started touring, I actually had some manuscripts out there. I had an agent on the hook. Like I was almost going to do that, and music happened. So I'm lucky that way.
It's interesting to think of that idea of where there's happenstance kind of intersects with what we can do, but it's also that idea as well of, it speaks to the value of having multiple talents and interests. Yeah. Because you have all these different options.
Yes, exactly. And you create your reality by having those options and nurturing them and sticking with them, whether they're paying off or whether they're, being gratified. That's something that I'm very lucky that I got early on. It's like, you know, make a living, be smart, but also don't give up on this other stuff. It's investigate that and make it part of you and don't leave it alone. Keep it close to your heart.
So you went from Minneapolis to Harvard for college, if I'm not mistaken.
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you were focused on, because I was kind of thinking, oh, would it be studying journalism? But you were focused on English and American literature. Was the idea that you might go into journalism, or was it just that's what you were studying? You weren't quite sure yet.
No, I had no interest in journalism. I thought I might try to take the academic path. And I was living after college. I lived in Budapest for a year, and I had an opportunity to take the GRE at the embassy there. And I walked in and I had no idea what any of the questions meant. So I walked out and I was like, that's the end of the academic thing. but it was there that I started writing some articles for the English language newspaper. And when I went back to Minneapolis after that, I wrote some freelance stuff and ended up actually working as a journalist at the St. Paul Pioneer Press, which is with the kind of big paper in our sister city, St. Paul, over there. So I was a journalist, but that's not where I was hoping to end up.
It's probably lucky just given the evolution of the business side of journalism, but,
yeah, you could tell even then it was kind of running on fumes.
Yeah. So where was that first thing where music started becoming a career? Was it kind of the first band? Was it something else after college?
Well, Well, I did do bands throughout high school. And then in college, I really didn't do a lot of music. I was just didn't have time and the energy. But then again, after college, my friend Arthur Phillips, who ended up being a novelist, and he started off as a musician, he lived there. And he's like, you know, if you don't have anything to do, I have a jazz band if you want to come over and give it a shot. So I did. And I sang just jazz standards for a year in Budapest. And that was, for me, that was kind of the beginning of the professionalism in music. You know, we played 4 or 5 nights a week, and I had to kind of gather up a repertoire and learn a lot of jazz standards and just kind of be professional, which I had never really done before. So it was a good education.
Well, I'd heard you talk about this in another interview, and you'd mentioned you had to learn something like hundreds of jazz standards.
Well, I didn't have to, but I did.
I mean, it probably sounded like so much work.
I did to keep it interesting, you know, and I was listening to my favorite singers, and anytime a song kind of hit me, I'd learn it and propose it to the band, and, you know, listening to Johnny Hartman and Chet Baker and Ella Fitzgerald and Nina Simone and stuff like that. And anytime I was like, that's a good song, I just kind of throw it on the pile.
Well, that always jumps out at me that, and you mentioned this a moment ago, the idea of professionalism is that distinction between here's what I want to play or here's what we are playing. Mm-hmm. And then that idea of I'm going to play 4 or 5 nights a week, which is one thing, or study a style of music or learn it so I can be performing it. One thing for me to learn how to play a song here in a room, very different thing to be performing it a week or two later.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think what I learned picking up all of these jazz standards is just because I like it doesn't mean people like it. and negotiating that and not necessarily giving in to what maybe popular demand would require, but sticking with your own path and your own taste, for lack of a better word. That was an important lesson. You know, if you're playing jazz to Hungarians, they want to hear things that might be passé to you. You know, they want to hear you do like Strange Fruits or things like that. And I was like, that's not what I'm into. And so you gotta learn to negotiate your own path and you know, obviously nod to the audience, but keep your own taste in mind.
I have to imagine that's a challenge that most performers or creatives feel, not just at some point in their career, but even almost more so the older they get, where with all of the different, you know, stages you've ever been on, where there might always be that tension a little bit, where there are people here who want to hear the hits or a certain song. Musicians on stage might be wanting to play some new thing or some rare cut or some cover that, yeah, like you say, might not be. And there's like, is there a tension in that, or is that's just the deal?
I think it's just the deal, or rather, there's a tension in that initially, and when once you learn how it works, it's just the deal. You know, it's one for them, one for you. It's kind of how it works. You know, you have to be fair, you have to be generous, but you also have to be a little bit selfish. And I think a lot of performers, or many, run into this, and that you can either be an artiste and it's like, you don't understand me, and or you have to realize that it's a relationship, it's a negotiation. And part of the reason that you're doing what you're doing is that you have an audience. So you have to respect that. But you also have to respect your own impetus and your own impulse and your own wishes and your own wants. And you know, it's like a weird marriage, I guess.
I love that. So when you describe that year of playing 4 or 5 nights a week, I'm kind of reminded of like the Beatles' time in Hamburg, Germany, where they, yeah, famously played, you know, every night, that sort of thing. Was it like that? Because you mentioned it really got you into the idea of the professionals in music. Was it this pivotal moment where you went from someone with a lot of talent, a lot of craft, and now you're moving into that professional area?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I had a lot of talent or craft, but it was definitely professional, and it was it was odd. I'd never had to do that before. And, you know, every night there are people coming, and hopefully if you're doing it well, more people are coming, and you have to figure out how to please them, and you have to figure out how to keep doing it and keeping it new and keeping it real and keeping yourself healthy. You know, when you're a high schooler or a college kid and you're playing in a band, you just, you have one show, you know, every 3 months, and you just give it your all. But if you have to do it night after night, you got to figure out how to be consistent, and how to deliver every night. You can't, there, you run into this thing where you're like, I don't feel like it. And there's no, I don't feel like it. And so you have to figure out how to keep yourself motivated, basically.
I love that. So many people I work with and talk to are writers, and I always look to other fields like musicians or comics where their craft can't always be done alone in a room where it's, you know, you've got to get up on stage. And that what you just said is something that I love thinking about, is that idea of keeping that part of yourself, of the audience, and then the idea in between of how you, I guess, rise to the occasion. Because it's not just that you're performing to an audience, like they're watching you. The idea of being on a stage is a very odd thing, I have to imagine, or it is to me as a total amateur.
It is strange, and I'm kind of a naturally shy person, and so it's odd that my job is being in front of people every night. There's a lot of interesting psychology that goes into it. I can't fully explain how it gets done, but you do have to think about it, and there's no phoning it in. It's just that doesn't exist. And so you have to figure out how to be real every night. And I would talk with some of my fellow musicians about that John Irving book where I think it's like the Hotel New Hampshire, where there's a hooker who has an orgasm with every customer. and you can't do that. you can't always be real. You can't always be 100% present, but it needs to seem that way. I don't know. Maybe the concept of prostitution is very relevant here. because you're in it. It's happening. You may not always be 100% present, but it's going to happen. You know, that might not be the most elegant metaphor, but that's kind of where I am now.
Well, but I mean, that's something I've thought about when I see a band I really like, or really any show, where for the person going out, even if it's a local thing and whatever band happens to be there, it's their night out. This is their time. And for that musician, it's the fifth show that week, or, mm-hmm. you know, these bands playing these stadiums or these shows, it's sort of like, this is what they've been doing for 20 years with some of the acts you've been playing with.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that's part of the craft. It's part of the, it's part of the job. One thing that hit me kind of early on, because I was really, especially when I joined Derek's band in the early 2000s, I was really trying to give it all every night. And after a certain point, you have to come to grips with the fact that you do have a talent. And so when you feel like you're at 60%, people think you're at 90%, you know? But that's a dangerous equation to deal with too, because then you can start be like, well, maybe I can just get 20%, you know. at a certain point, you have to kind of give yourself credit for what you do and your talent and the time you've put in. And if you know you're not at 100%, sometimes you have to be a little forgiving of yourself. It took me a while to get there. But you know, you're trying to give 100%. You're always trying to do your best, but it's not always going to happen. It's impossible. You're just a person, you know?
So what were the years when you came back, I guess working in journalism after you came back, or I don't know if that was before, but the years between coming back from Hungary and then joining Derek's band, what was that time like?
That was the 90s, mid 90s. That's when I lived in Minneapolis and worked as a journalist for a while. And then I moved to New York with the band that I had, actually, and we're going to try to kind of make it And that ended up kind of evolving into the band I still have, Scrap-O-Matic, which I do with my friend Paul Olson. He lives in Nashville now, but we've been doing this since 1998, 99 or something. But through that band is how I ran into Derek and started touring officially.
So in that time, was it like, you know, Scrap-O-Matic, this is our shot, this is going to be our band? Was it like you were just working it like that?
That's exactly how we worked it. And again, we went to New York as a different band. We ended up just kind of as a foot stomping blues duo. And it was a good time to be in New York. It was kind of the end of the record industry. We didn't know that, but it was. And, you know, the downtown Lower East Side scene, kind of singer-songwriter thing going on. There were all kinds of people that we played with, and Nora Jones, and a bunch of other people who ended up becoming quite famous. But you know, it was a vibrant scene, and it just felt like something was happening, and we just kind of threw it at the wall. We're like, this is it. We're in New York City. Let's just give it a shot. And that's how I came to the attention of Derek, whose singer had left their band when they were recording their first album. And so it just kind of serendipitous that way.
Before that opportunity came up, because I always think of how hard it is to really survive, like just financially survive as a musician. And then it's such a weird, it's like a lot of the, you know, it's like Hollywood, where there's this industry where you can just survive for years at this certain level, but people want more success often. They want a record deal, or they want to be touring. How was it just in those years of just getting by, or was it, well, no, a lot of stuff was happening and it was sort of going somewhere?
That's a good question. I think the means was the ends for us. Like we had an audience. We built an audience. We had a repertoire. We were having fun writing songs, and that was good enough. You know, and we were young too. I mean, we were in our 20s. We didn't have a lot of responsibility. And so we're like, yeah, this is just what you do until something else happens. So we weren't suffering or struggling or bitter that people weren't giving us more attention or something like that. It was just like, it was just what we do. We were all in. And I kind of missed that. I mean, looking back on it, it was a little naive. But we were just... Paul and I were just psychopaths. Like we were all about the blues, and we had our, you know, 7 gigs a month, and we were just, that's what we did, and nothing else really mattered. So it was a kind of a, I look back at that nostalgically.
So how did you first hear about the opportunity with Derek? How did that first come to you? And was it something that you were interested in, or was it tearing you away from something you'd built?
Good question. I got a call from Blake Budney, Derek's manager. He had heard of me through John Snyder, who is a producer who produced Scrap-O-Matic's first couple records. And he found us through his son, who worked with Chocolate Genius, who is Mark Anthony Thompson, who's a great singer-songwriter. I always call him kind of like the Black Tom Waits. And Paul and I were enamored with him, and we fought tooth and nail to get opening slots for him. And we did. We did a couple shows with him. But John Snyder's son alerted John to us, and he's like, oh, these guys are pretty good. And he had produced Derek's first couple records. So when Derek's singer left, this is convoluted, he recommended me. And then Chocolate Genius, his producer, Craig Street, recommended me to Derek, who was doing Derek's record at the time. So Derek was in this hotel room in New York, and he got these two Scrap-O-Matic records from two people who didn't know each other, you know, at his hotel room on the same day. And he's like, wow, that's weird. And I tell this story, nobody believes me, but it is true. I was leaving my day job in Midtown, getting on the E train. And there's a tap on my shoulder, and he's like, hey, are you Mike Madison? I was like, yeah, who are you? And it was Derek Trucks. I didn't know who he was. And he's like, yeah, I got your records at my hotel room. I was like, okay, whatever. And he's like, yeah, we should play sometime. I was like, okay. Yeah, I didn't know who he was. But then I got the call from his manager, and he's like, would you like to try to do this? And it just kind of ended up working out.
There's so much in there. But that idea of like collaboration, of having a network, how it can quote unquote pay off. Yeah. And even just that moment of luck that he happened to get two people who recommended you and the CDs, you know, in his hotel room that day. And then the most bizarre thing, you happened to be on the same subway train.
Yeah, that was
which is insane.
That was the whipped cream on the whole Sunday. But it's like I used to say with Paul when we were kind of in our hard charging late 90s era. You know, we'd see all these billboards for the New York Lottery and their motto was, you got to be in it to win it. And you have to just do it. You have to grind it out and you never know what's going to happen and nothing might happen. But you have to be, to my mind, you have to be fanatically in it. And it ended up working out for us in a way that we never expected. But to answer your other question, it was weird going off and starting to tour with Derek because it didn't make a rift in what I was doing with Paul, but it strained it a little bit. You know, we negotiated all of that and figured out how to keep doing what we were doing and make it work.
Was there a moment where you remember deciding, yeah, I'm going to do this, or was it always just happened so naturally?
Yeah, no, I had to make that choice. I mean, I had a really good job. I was working for a friend of mine who had a company that did PR for basically mutual funds, financial stuff. And I was an editor there. And they were very generous. I mean, the people, my friend and his partner were basically artists themselves. And they're like, hey, if you want to be a musician, you can still do this job and take a couple months off a year and still do it. And so, I mean, I could have really negotiated that and done it safely. But this offer came from Derek and I was like, well, you kind of get one shot. So I went with it. You know, it's worked out, but it was a hard choice.
Was it an interesting transition? Cause Derek had a big following. You know, he's just a big name out there where you're stepping into something where it's maybe different expectations, different audience. Like you're thrown onto a train that's already moving at full steam. Mm-hmm. Was there any, what was that like, I guess?
Oh, it was fun. You know, it was, you know, I went from playing to 100 people in a room to playing to thousands of people. But also they were still kind of up and coming. And so there was a real esprit de corps. You know, there was five of us and a couple of crew guys on a bus. And it was just like, it's just us against the world. So it was fun. It was fun. You know, you hit the ground running. And luckily for me, I didn't have to be like a front man. It was his band. And so I was just kind of another member of the ensemble. So I didn't have to step in and kind of own it. You know, I was just kind of a guy who walked on stage and sang every once in a while. So it wasn't that daunting in terms of having to get in there and just make an impact. You know, it was gradual.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I went back and watched so many videos and it's, you know, Derek is this, you know, his name is on the band, you know, all his talent and skill, but you're also the one for the songs you're singing. Like you are front stage center, you know, he's got a spotlight on him. He's a little bit back, but it's like, you're driving the whole presence in that song too, where that's another thing where there's that, I don't know if it's called balance, but that idea of like, at some points in the night, you are the front man of the band. True. To a certain degree.
Yeah. Well, but and another thing I had going for me is in that group, it was really all about the music. It was very pure in that sense. There was no jive. We weren't trying to sell anything. It was very purely musical. And so I didn't have to get out there and do jumping jacks or like run up and down ramps or anything. And you know, that kind of fit my personality too. A lot of people thought, you know, at our record company, especially, that we should be a little more entertaining, but it just wasn't who we were. You know, it was really about the music.
You mentioned this, and this is just something that's always fascinating to me. Like, how do you live on a bus with 5 or 6 or 10 other people, city to city? Like, that is a really distinct It's like a lifestyle. It's like a life choice in a way, because it means you don't have the comforts that most people have. And even the way it affects relationships or family, it sort of affects everything.
It does. It does. And you have to be very malleable, and you have to learn to get along. You're literally living on top of each other. But we did, and you know, there are worse ways to do it. I mean, as we're driving around from city to city, we're like, at least we're on a bus and we get to sleep. You know, we're not in a rental car or a van. I mean, so it was, in a way, for me, it was a step up. It was very cushy. But you know, it was a good group of people. We had Todd Smalley, Rico Scott, Kofi Burbridge, just good guys. Like, interesting, not just musically, but just, you know, everyone's from a different place, has a whole different experience, but just fascinating people, and really kind, and fun and talented, and we just had a blast. Like, there was no suffering going on. We had a great time.
At some point in here, there's Grammy Awards happening. Am I mistaken in this?
You know, I came in when they were doing their first big major label album, and I wasn't really on it. And so they had this album out, but there's a singer who wasn't on it, and it was weird, but they let that happen. And then we did another record with Jay Joyce, who's a great producer out of Nashville, and he really brought out some interesting stuff in the band. But we weren't really making our own statements. We weren't writing a lot, and that's where I come from. What I was doing with Paul, that's what I was really interested in, is songwriting. And finally, we got to a place where I don't think I'm speaking out of turn. I think we just became less interesting to our label because we weren't selling a bunch of records. And they, instead of cutting us loose, they kind of just let us do whatever we wanted to do, because it's like, well, who knows? Maybe you'll come up with something. And around this time, Derek built his studio behind his house in Jacksonville. And it was still literally like still being constructed, but we started recording this album. And again, we weren't written off, but I just think people, they had no expectations, and that was very freeing for us. And so we did a ton of writing together, and really kind of, to my mind, made our first actual statement as a band, as a group, as collaborators with our record Already Free. And it's kind of a blues-based singer-songwritery album, and we're just like, well, that was fun. I'm glad they let us do that. And then we got nominated and won a Grammy, which blew our minds, you know. And we're like, you like that? But I think it speaks to the idea that you are, that people respond to a real, genuine statement. And instead of trying to do something that you think you should do, you just do it. And it's hard to get to that place. It's hard to get that freedom, especially when you're attached to a record company and stuff like that. But we just kind of found the sweet spot, and it just kind of happened. It was very organic, and the fact that people responded to that was very moving. It kind of blew our minds.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So, not long after this was essentially the change in bands,
Yeah.
where, to my understanding, it's basically, Derek's band and his wife's band combined in a way, but formed something brand new where they were combining forces. Is that an okay way of describing it?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, it's Susan started playing. She had many different iterations of her bands over the years, and she finally started playing with what was essentially Scrap-O-Matic, my band. She started playing with Tyler Greenwell, Ted Pecchio, and the great Dave Yoke, and she kind of brought them in, which worked out well because she could do things like pay them money. So that worked out well. But when they just decided as a couple that, you know, if we're going to be running around the world with our two kids at home, we might as well just do it together and bring our kids out when we can. And so it made perfect sense. And when they combined, some of us kind of made the cut, I guess, is the way to say it. It was a bumpy transition, but it worked out pretty well in the end. And that's how we became the Tedeschi Trucks Band.
It's funny because that band is something like 10 or 11 or 12 people. It's this huge ensemble.
There's a lot of us. Yeah. I think it's 12. I think. Yeah. Yeah. And that was their idea is not directly, but they use the Joe Cocker Mad Dogs and Englishmen idea is just put a street gang on stage and see what happens. and they got a lot of their dream players. You know, they got J.J. Johnson, the great drummer, was with us in the beginning. Oteel Burbridge, Kofi's brother, and it had been Oteel and Kofi's dream to play together for a long time. And so it was fun. It was kind of just like throw everything at the wall and see what happens. It was chaotic, but it was fun.
See, your role in the band from an outside observer seemed to have changed because now she is singing, she's front stage with him. Yep. How did your role change and how did you sort of process that in a way?
Well, it was weird because, you know, we'd had the success with the Derek Trucks Band and then their combining bands. I was like, is this the right time to do that? But it happened. But you know, they were very gracious kind of making the space for me. In that I would come out and sing a couple songs and I think my role there too was kind of being that there was a lot of virtuosity flying around and a lot of jazz motivation happening and I think my role then and now too is to kind of keep one toe in the hard blues thing and keep us grounded that way, for lack of a better word. So I feel like that's kind of my place. And then also bringing the songwriting thing to the group as well. So, and again, I'm not a guy who likes to put on like a nylon flight suit and go on and do jumpy jacks and tell people to say, hell yeah, and all that stuff. Like, so I'm okay being in the background a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting. I always think of this from, again, because I work with so many people who are creating, is I think there's this idea in life where maybe it's a hope. I hope someone notices what I create and that there's this like upward trajectory. So it's like, you've got a band, you're doing okay in New York, and then you get invited to join this bigger band and then you're sort of front stage center. And what I like when I'm kind of looking at your career, anyone's career, is the idea that it's not just this thing going up. It is this living with music and living with collaboration. And there are all different ways of doing that where you're always kind of finding your place and figuring out what's next. Is that?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And that's the gift of it too, is just the doing of it and being with people who feel the same way. I know so many bands get torn apart because of this careerism, I guess. And one thing I've always loved about Derek and Susan is they're lifers. They're in it. They're like, I'm going to do this no matter what. And it's going to go up. It's going to go down. We'll probably end up in a van again. It doesn't matter. It's the point is that you get to do it, and you get to do it with people who you respect and who respect you back. That's the gift. The music business itself is like walking into a casino. You're probably not going to walk out a millionaire, but it's just, it's fun to be there, you know? And if I kind of have to conceive of it that way, otherwise I don't know, I'd probably just end up very sad.
Yeah. I've heard you talk elsewhere about again, you mentioned that word professionals and like what you've learned from Derek and Susan about the business and all of that. And you've been, I mean, it feels like you've played with so many different people in different ways, different people who I guess I could describe as legends, you know, or incredible performers. And it feels like it's that reminder as well, where we get these moments in life where we are able to collaborate. And it's that moment we've got to kind of be in, like, almost like you're saying, be in the right place at the right time in some ways.
Yeah. Be in the right place, right time, but also be in the moment. Like and it's funny, you know, you mentioned you get to meet some of your idols, you know, because the music business is a small world and you will run into pretty much everybody if you do it long enough. And the people who are still there, who are still doing it, end up being quite humble and quite kind and encouraging. It's the wannabes who are kind of jackasses, you know. But when you meet your idols, it's reassuring that they're very down to earth, because they've gone through the same thing. They've had their ups and downs. It hasn't all been an upward trajectory, and they know that you're gonna meet the same people going up as you meet going down. And I go back to John Snyder, who was our first producer, who introduced me to Derek, and he was a real mentor, and he still is. But he had some great advice. He's like getting into music business. He said, you know, I can teach you how to bob and weave, but you will get hit. And he was right. He was 100% right. But he also said something that I laughed about when he told me 20 years ago, but it turns out to have been correct. He said, here's what you do. You figure out who has what you want. You walk into their office. You tell them to give it to you. And if they don't, you say, go fuck yourself. And I was like, well, that's a terrible, way to approach things. But it turns out he's right. Oh my God. He's like, meaning, I guess you have to have that confidence. Yeah. And that, you shouldn't be a dick, but you have to have that self-assurance that what you're doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
He also described it to me early on too. He's like, don't forget this. People are going to minimize you and tell you you're not giving them what they need to make money, blah, blah, blah. But he's like, when you sit down and you write a song and you work on it and you edit it and you make it a thing, you created value out of thin air. You literally mined gold. He's like, what you're doing is magic. So when you're dealing with these people in their offices, don't forget that. Like, have that confidence that you're a creator. They can't do that. You can. And I think that's what he meant when he was saying, tell people to F off.
Oh, that's really beautiful.
I think about that a lot. Yeah.
So throughout this time, you're still doing solo recordings. You're a part of the band. Is your life sort of almost entrepreneurial in a way where you are always thinking up, what do I know I'll be involved with? And then what do I want to do in addition to that, including the book, which we'll talk about?
Yeah. Well, not entrepreneurial necessarily. I wish I was more entrepreneurial, but I think it's just creative. One nice thing about going all in doing music or doing something creative is that creativity begets creativity. And so if you're doing something with one group, you're thinking, I could be doing this over here. You know, the possibilities start compounding themselves. And so it's a good place to be. And that's why I've been lucky that Paul has stuck with me, and we keep doing Scrapmatic stuff. And I do my own albums, and so whenever I'm writing a song, there's these different venues I can bring it to, which is a real luxury, but a lot of people don't have that. And so if something occurs to me, there's a venue for it, and so I've lucked out that way.
So you have a new book coming out called Poetic Song Verse, and I mean, the thing I think about a lot now, and all I do is really work with so many writers, but why write a book? Why is this a book and not a podcast series, or a book and not a video series, or a book and not a spoken word and music tour? Why a book?
Well, I can tell you, the impetus comes directly from Ernest Suarez, my collaborator, who's a professor. He runs the English department at Catholic University. And I met him serendipitously, years and years ago. It must have been 15 years ago. He was doing an article for the Washington Post. He does a lot of music writing on the side, on Derek. And he was asking if he could talk to some of the band members on background. And Derek said, well, why don't you talk to Mike? Because he's into poetry and stuff. And so he called me, and we just had a hours-long conversation talking about poetry, basically, and music. And he has taught this course for over 20 years, I think, called Poetry and Rock. And in academia and academic scholarship, there's a lot of work on poetry and music, poetry and jazz, poetry and blues, but not poetry and rock. It's an interesting thing. And so we kind of started this ongoing conversation about that. And I would go and visit him and sit in on his classes, and we talk about songwriting and stuff like that. And he came up with this idea that basically in the 60s, popular rock music took on a poetic significance. And he's like, how did that happen? What was going on? What were the forces at work? And he had an idea that we should try to write a book about it. And then in the midst of writing the book, he came up with this idea that there's a new genre. It's not poetry, and it's not rock, and it's not pop music. It's poetic song verse, this type of music that has a popular music, blues based, that has a poetic seriousness. And then we kind of kept going from there. And so we've been writing this for about 8 years, I think. But it just has come out of this just ongoing conversation, really, about how do we talk about the music we love, and which is basically from the 60s into the 70s, 80s and beyond. And so that's how it all came about.
Yeah, it's fascinating because on the one hand, the book is positing what you're saying here, this idea of this new form of literature and where it comes from. And then the book is just filled with these stories and these analyses where I feel like I'm a big music fan. I watch tons of documentaries and interviews, and it's just filled with these stories or these analyses of a song that I'd never heard of, never considered before, like the double meanings of things, the way characters are used. And what was that process like of either researching this, or if it was something you've been talking about, of deciding what stories do we either match together? Because a lot of times there's like, let's talk about two singers or two songs and we'll kind of pair them. What was that creative process like?
Well, I mean, the great thing about working with Ernest is he's wide open. He's like, what do you think? And I was like, oh, me? Oh. and so he kind of, you know, we just kind of followed our muses on that, in terms of which artists to talk about. You know, you always circle back around on Dylan because he's kind of the touchstone of this stuff, who just kind of demanded that the genre take on a poetic seriousness. And he became world famous for it. But when he was doing it, he was just kind of an oddball. And he's lucky John Hammond took a chance on him, you know, but he really kind of changed the world in a way. And I there's a great quote I know that Ernest always brings up with Lucinda Williams. It's you know, before Dylan, there was nothing. Like we didn't know you were allowed to bring this seriousness to the genre, because it was really kids music in terms of rock and roll. And then in the folk music, it was almost this sentimental respect for like the working man and the minority and stuff like that. But there was a lot of poeticism in the music, but it wasn't poetry. And Dylan's like, he's like, I'm into poets. Like, let's do this. But like, I think the audience is there where we can treat this music like poetry, meaning you have to, like you say, you have to come at it with a seriousness, and you have to treat it as multi-leveled and filled with all this, bursting with all of this meaning, that you have to come back to it repeatedly. It's not just something you hear and you fart out. It's you have to bring yourself to it and really consider it and listen to it over and over. And that's the poetic song verse, I think.
I mean, that's something that always strikes me about music, and that I love all the arts, but there's something about, you know, I'll read my favorite book a couple times, watch a movie 10 times in my lifetime if I really love that movie. Mm-hmm. A song I'll listen to 100 times in a month easily.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's that repetition changes you in some way.
It really does. And I think the idea of poetry has been kept alive in poetic song verse, is that, you know, in our cars and in our CD players and whatever we have now, we listen to vinyl. It's that's what poetry is. It goes to work on you, and you have to work back towards it. And it's a back and forth. It's a relational thing. It's not just disposable. And I'm just grateful that strain developed in popular music. We're very lucky that it did. Like you say, like, these songs change your life. I believe that.
Well, it was funny reading some of the analyses of the songs, and I'm like, wow, I never thought of it that way. And it's this weird thing with, I guess it's with all creative work, but, you know, we're talking about songwriting here, is that in one sense, some of these songs are written really quickly, you know, like just almost in moments. And the other end, you're able to analyze it line by line as a poem and talk about the characterization and the, you know, and then even the ways things, you know, people got around censorship. Well, the song sounds like it's about a car race or it's about a guy and a girl, but really it's about this whole other thing. And like line by line, you're able to analyze layers, you know, like how in college I would study poetry and we'd spend a week, 3 weeks on one poem because there's the layers to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's the gift that keeps on giving. And, you know, it's interesting researching some of this stuff. Like you say, like a lot of these songs came, it's like a gift from heaven. They just dropped in the composer's lap and that's it, you know? And then at other times they struggled over years and ground it out to make something out of it. And that's the creative process. And that is, again, the gift. Like you just never know how it's going to come. But, you know, some of those Bob Dylan tunes, I can't remember which one in particular, but, you know, it just happened in an evening. Whereas Leonard Cohen, for example, I think Hallelujah, I think he wrote something like, he said something like 200 verses of that and then cut it down to like the 7 that it is. And it took him 5 years to do it, 7 years. But he stuck with it because he knew he was on to something, you know. But that's the beauty of it. But these things, they'll last forever. And it's funny that sometimes it just comes and sometimes you got to go to war for it, you know.
We've covered a lot. Is there anything I haven't asked about with any of these topics that you feel we should definitely cover?
Oh gosh. No, this has just been really fun. It's been very challenging. You're making me work. no, not really. I mean, no, it's just, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about, you know, being creative. It's not stuff, you know, it's stuff you talk about with your friends and colleagues, but doesn't really, it's not a daily thing. So I appreciate it.
Mike, thank you so much. It's been totally inspiring speaking with you. And I just want to say thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
You can find Mike Matteson really just by doing an internet search on his name. That's Mattison. His new book is called Poetic Songverse, Blues, Bass, Popular Music, and Poetry. His latest solo album is called Afterglow. Of course, you can look up the Tedeschi Trucks Band to find his music with them. Highly recommend you go on YouTube, just do a search on his name or the band's name, and you'll find loads of videos and performances, other interviews, that sort of thing. My name again is Dan Blank. You can find me at wegrowmedia.com or on social media at Dan Blank. Thank you so much for listening until the end.